The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice, and it's great to be with you. This week, articles of impeachment have been drawn up for the President of the United States.
This is only the third time in the history of the United States of America that formal impeachment articles have passed this far.
And the Inspector General for the Justice Department, David Horowitz, issues his report.
This report was always about whether or not the FBI, in the course of its investigation, abused its powers.
We'll look at the chill on First Amendment free expression.
We, with this film, want to raise awareness and really open people's eyes to how serious and how dangerous this has become.
And the film No Safe Spaces, now in theaters, tells the tale.
If you can't express to me ideas that I disagree with, this is not America any longer.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, coming to you from my home station of KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on KPDQ 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website, kpdq.com, and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. It was an historic moment this week in the U.S. House of Representatives. Yes, those of you who have been tracking the news have seen it coming, but the news is notable nonetheless. For only the third time in our nation's history, the groundwork has been laid for the House of Representatives to vote to impeach a sitting president of the United States. It's a sobering development, a development that says as much about our polarized political environment as it does about the conduct of the man in the Oval Office. To make that point, we'll turn to Albert Mohler, who presented extensive coverage of the news in his briefing program.
The Democratic leadership in the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives released articles of impeachment to be voted on by the committee on Thursday, and if approved by the committee as expected, by the House of Representatives sometime next week. The actual text of the articles of impeachment begin with this formal language, quote, resolved that Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the following articles of impeachment be exhibited to the United States Senate. The constitutional background to this is the fact that there is an impeachment clause in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution concerning the President of the United States, and the language, high crimes and misdemeanors, is the constitutional language, although, of course, it is a largely non-defined constitutional language. Impeachment in any context is an inherently political act. It is undertaken by elected officials. In the House of Representatives, the trial is then undertaken by elected senators, the United States Senate, and the person at the center of the impeachment case in this particular instance is the elected president of the United States. So given that fact alone, we are looking at an inherently political process. Then you add the deep partisan divides that now mark the United States, and there is no way that this is not an overtly political act. Political acts leading up to the articles of impeachment, a political act by the Judiciary Committee, and of course, eventually by the Senate, and so it goes. But to say that an act is inherently political does not mean that it is not deeply significant. This is, after all, only the third time in the history of the United States of America that formal impeachment articles have passed this far through the United States House. That is in itself not only historically, but morally significant. It tells us that we are at a moment of tremendous political tension in the United States. There are those who are declaring that we are in the midst of a constitutional crisis, but that language is actually quite overblown. The best evidence for the fact that it is exaggerated is the fact that everything that is taking place right now is taking place within the constitutional order. You only have a constitutional crisis when that constitutional order breaks down. You don't have a crisis when the order is working. But at the same time, in this deeply partisan age, given the deeply political aspect of these impeachment proceedings, we are looking at what cannot be described at this point as a trophy of American constitutionalism. We're looking at a very odd moment, and we are likely to see many other odd and awkward moments during the weeks and months ahead.
The other big news coming out of the nation's capital this week was the release of the much-anticipated report from David Horowitz, the Inspector General at the Department of Justice. He was looking into the origins of the Trump-Russia investigation with particular attention to FISA court surveillance of then-Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Elite media outlets presented the Horowitz report as though it vindicated the FBI. That was deliberately inaccurate. My colleague in New York City, Kevin McCullough, turned to Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal from AM 570, The Mission.
You've got blockbuster insight on what's going on with the IG report. It's been available now for a little while. You've had a chance to look at it. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, I think the really important thing here, Kevin, top takeaway, is that if you listen to some in the media and Democrats, they're now attempting to change around what this report was meant to be about. And they're claiming vindication because Horowitz, the FBI did their investigation. Horowitz didn't say, oh, you should not have done the investigation. You didn't have a valid predicate for doing investigation. He didn't score them for that. But that's never what this report was supposed to be. This report was always about whether or not the FBI, in the course of its investigation, abused its powers, and namely whether it abused its powers with regard to the FISA court process and its desire to obtain warrants to surveil American citizens. And there is no question that the report does find that there was abuse of power there in terms of what the FBI told the court, whether or not it provided exculpatory evidence, and other things like that.
One of the big arguments going into this was, would the IG ding the FBI for basically making the Steele dossier the heaviest weight of its presentation of evidence before the FISA court? And in my estimation, that is an abuse of power. It's misleading. What does it say in relationship to that?
Well, look, this is really important. It wasn't even just whether or not they would get dinged for that. But we're still, as American citizens, dealing with the question of whether or not the dossier was a central part of that application. Because right. Don't forget, Devin Nunes, the former head of the House Intelligence Committee, put out a memo at the end of January of 2018. The Republicans have finally been allowed to look at these FISA applications. And they said, wow, this is terrible. The bulk of this application is based on a document that was provided from the rival campaign. And don't forget, a month later, Adam Schiff, the minority member of the Intelligence Committee at that time, put out a rival memo saying, no, it wasn't the basis of that. Well, now we do know. In fact, it was. Devin Nunes was being straight with the country. Yes, it was the bulk of that. And then you look at the further details, the FBI knew that this guy was a political actor, and yet they presented him as a straight-up source. There were other issues to deal with his credibility, which they did not tell the court. I mean, these are things that really ought to concern people.
So the bottom line takeaway is Nunes was telling the truth and Schiff was lying.
Yes. No. And I think that this is really, really important. What this Horowitz report fundamentally is, even though it doesn't say so explicitly, is it is an enormous condemnation of Schiff and the Democrats and everything that they put out in that memo. And it suggested that if he can be trusted even at that point, he certainly cannot be trusted in the things that he's been doing throughout these impeachment proceedings.
The shortcomings that we see from such an enormously powerful law enforcement agency ought to be a warning for all Americans, whether left, right, center, or apolitical. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina summed things up at the end of Wednesday's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Let me just end with where I began. Rather than debating whether or not there was a legal predicate, reasonable articulation, which is a very low standard, to open up a preliminary investigation. Durham will have his view of what really happened. He may know more than you. I don't know. I trust him to be fair. I trust you to be fair. The fact that three lawyers disagree is okay. No one's ever suggested y'all did a bad job. You've done a great job. You can reach your conclusion about the legal predicate, and you have, and I respect it. And I'm going to assume for a moment that's the right conclusion. That doesn't matter at all to me, because after it was opened, it became a nightmare. It became something that can never happen again. It became, over time, a criminal conspiracy to defraud the court. It became an effort by lawyers to doctor evidence. It became a conscious effort to deny the court exculpatory information about an American citizen. They should have stopped, at least in January 2017, when the Russian subsource said, "Everything in the dossier I disavow." Poor Carter Page. Two more warrant renewals after they were on notice the dossier was unreliable. All I can say is that why they did it, you can make your own decision. But it's pretty clear to me that this was a lot of things, but it was not a counterintelligence investigation to protect Donald Trump. This was opened as a counterintelligence investigation, and it kept going and going and going after it should have stopped, because the last thing on their mind was to protect Donald Trump. A lot of the key players here were upset with the outcome of the 2016 election, and man, they had a lot of power. And that's what worries me the most. You may not like what the American people do, but you should honor their decision. And the reason the investigation survived and kept going after so many stop signs is because people wanted it to keep going. The reason nobody briefed Donald Trump about you may have people working for you connected to Russia is they could give a damn about protecting him. This is just my view. It's kind of odd that in a counterintelligence investigation, you never brief the person who's the subject of the foreign influence, like you did Dianne Feinstein and like they did Hillary Clinton. So the bottom line here is, I hope we never have a defensive briefing or intelligence briefing where you send an FBI agent to do a 302 on the people you're briefing. This is some really scary stuff. I think I know what their motivation was, but it doesn't matter. They did it. Hope somebody holds them accountable. And I hope it never, ever happens again. To my Democratic friends, this could happen to you one day. Mr. Horowitz, do you agree that every politician in America should be concerned about what happened here?
I'll go further. Every American should want to make sure this FISA process works the right way.
Finally, to those of us in politics, how easy it is for somebody to come in our lives and our campaigns as volunteers. And I would hope the FBI would tell me if they've got a reasonable suspicion that somebody in my campaign is a bad actor, so I can do something about it. What scares me the most is that the power to open up a counterintelligence investigation is almost unlimited. The power to abuse it is exactly what your report tells us about.
Coming up, the growing threat to free expression.
We, with this film, want to raise awareness and really open people's eyes to how serious and how dangerous this has become.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. One of the sad consequences of our increasingly divided country is the erosion of free expression, whether it comes from policies on a college campus, for example, or through pressure from cultural elites who seek to shame people into silence, the trend is not good. A new film in theaters now tells the chilling tale. It's called No Safe Spaces. Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla partnered to make this powerful and timely film. Justin Folk, who directed the film, joined me on my program. Well, this is really very exciting. There's been a lot of buzz around the film. Tell us a bit about the movie, the docudrama slash documentary, No Safe Spaces.
Well, we feel like our movie is a movie about how America is special. And it's always been special because it's a place where people could come and believe what they want to believe and say what they want to say and express themselves in the manner that they wish to do so. And lately that's come under attack and in a dangerous way. And so No Safe Spaces dives into a very important issue in our country today. And we, with this film, want to raise awareness and really open people's eyes to how serious and how dangerous this has become. Even as we were making the film, I think we didn't even quite realize how deep and how dark this issue is in American culture, and not just on campuses, but in society at large. We're seeing this suppression of speech happening in tech, in the media, and even at places at work. People are afraid to speak up about their real opinions about any number of issues.
There's no question that conservatives are pushing back hard against this challenge to free expression. But the Coalition of the Frustrated now includes a growing number of voices on the left. Mark Joseph, the producer, joined Don Crow from WAVA in the nation's capital.
Talk about this impressive cast of, I will say, diverse cast of people in this movie. What can you tell us about that first?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. We did try to assemble a diverse cast from the right, the left, the center, you name it, from the same universe of people. I have Van Jones, Alan Dershowitz, Cornel West from the left side of the aisle, and from the right, Ben Shapiro, Ann Coulter, and somewhere in the middle, Jordan Peterson. But we tried to find a consensus. We raised the issues of what happens when a country in which 50% of young people don't believe in the right to free speech, if it's offensive, what happens when that group gets into positions of power? What happens when they're politicians, Supreme Court justices, city planners? What's going to happen when that ethos hits the culture? So we thought we were making a movie about college campuses, but we quickly figured out it was really about America as a whole and the intolerance that is developing to any idea that disagrees with your idea.
I'm glad you said that last point, because it really has not stopped at the edges of college campuses or university campuses. For years, that may have been the matrix, the birthplace of a lot of this stuff, but it really has infected the culture at large now, hasn't it?
It has. And, you know, comedians are the last bastion of hope for us. We have a comedy roundtable in the film, and as you said, it has a lot of variety. We have interviews with folks. We have Adam and Dennis traveling to college campuses. But one of the things we have is a comedy roundtable at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. And I have Tim Allen and Adam Carolla and some other comedians are talking about these comedians are now afraid to go on college campuses. They actually won't play college campuses because if they get one word or one sentence wrong, they get harassed and harangued, and it's just not worth it. So when the comedians can't tell jokes, we know we're in trouble.
What led to this? What's the backdrop of how this, I think it's very much needed, but where did this all start? Was it a Prager idea or yours as a producer or maybe a combination of several heads getting together? Where did this come from?
You know, it was an idea that I was kicking around and Tim Allen and I were talking about doing it with him. And then we just decided to go a different direction. And so I brought the idea to Adam and Dennis, and we just thought it'd be a perfect combination with the two of them because they really are sort of the odd couple. Obviously, Dennis is a rock-ribbed conservative, and Adam is pretty progressive liberal on most issues, but very open-minded. In fact, Adam Carolla, even though he's an atheist, has been listening to Christian talk radio, for years. And that kind of personifies what the movie is about, which is you should be able to listen to ideas you don't agree with and still be able to listen to them and consider them. Otherwise, you know, what's the point of being human if you only listen to ideas you agree with and you never change your mind on anything? So these two guys teaming up, we went to college campuses and traveled the country, and it's a lot of fun. It's an adventure movie. There's a lot of fun. There's humor. But it's also been described by my friend Alice Cooper as the greatest horror film he's ever seen.
I was just looking at that statement. I was going to ask you about that. He did say, I've seen almost every horror movie, and this is by far the scariest. Reality is much scarier than fiction. So this really is a hand on the pulse of America currently as a culture, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, we have to remind, Reagan used to say that freedom is one generation away from extinction. And I think we've forgotten that we have to remind our kids and our grandkids of things that we take for granted. And, you know, when we were kids and we were playing stickball or baseball in the street and somebody would say something crazy, we would just say, well, it's free speech, freedom of speech. It's America. You can say whatever you want. We took that for granted. Our kids and grandkids don't understand that. And we literally have to explain to them, just because something makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean that the other person can't say it. And by the way, we're not talking about harassing or, you know, things that are against the law or yelling fire in a crowded movie theater. We're talking about ideas. And if you can't express to me ideas that I disagree with, this is not America any longer.
And actually, that seems to have turned much of the college campus climate on its head, because historically that's what colleges and universities prided themselves in, being open to discussion and debate and ideas with which you may not agree.
That's right. That's the great American tradition. And, you know, part of it, too, is it's important that you feel you be confident in your ideas. And I think part of this idea of protecting yourself and creating safe spaces and bubbles is people aren't very confident in what they believe. And if you're confident in what you believe, you can be exposed to other ideas, and you either change your mind, adjust your ideas, or you stand firmly for them. But the notion that I should retreat to a safe space on a college campus or in a city where I don't have to hear your ideas really shows a lack of confidence in your own ideas.
What are you hoping, both short-term and long, that will be the takeaway for Americans as they see this?
Well, listen, I have to tell you, sometimes more conservative talk radio fans will complain about Hollywood and bias and so forth. But I'll tell you one thing. Movie theater chains are not red or blue. They are simply green. And they will keep a film in a theater as long as people watch it. So if your folks will come out and support these films. And I also want to add, you know, film going is a lot like voting. If you don't show up to vote, your vote doesn't get counted. If you do show up at the movie theater, your votes are counted. And on Monday morning, trust me, that vote reverberates all across Hollywood when they read the box office reports. And so it's really important to engage. Go to the films that are worthy of support. Stay home from the ones that aren't. And that is a form of voting for Hollywood's sake.
Coming up, the good fruits of gratitude.
King David kind of does the exact same thing in Psalm 103. He says, I'm going to consider the benefits of God. And he doesn't consider material benefits. He considers spiritual benefits.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they're preparing leaders for the public square. It might be the right step for you or the recent college graduate in your life. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. Gratitude is an essential disposition to have before God. And for the serious Christian, gratitude ought to mark us. Recent research has confirmed that practicing gratitude is actually good for your health. Robert Emmons, a researcher at UC Davis, says gratitude is the ultimate performance-enhancing substance. John Hall and Kathy Emmons turn to the subject with Tim Muehlhoff of Biola University on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so you gave us an assignment, and it was that every day we were to take some time and do what?
And just write down three things that you're grateful for, three positives rather than negatives. We were talking about the positive recall bias, that a psychologist from Harvard believes that we can actually train our brains to do one of two things. One, to notice the positive things in life, or we can train ourselves to notice the negative things of life. So we decided to take him at his word, and for 1 week, we decided, all three of us, that we would look at the positives, just write down three, once a day for 5 minutes at the same time. And I have my list. Do you guys have yours?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
What kind of things were on your list?
Well, here's what I want to say first, that as the week went on, Tim, what I found was that my gratitude was in two arenas. I looked at gratitude from a microscope and from a telescope.
Yeah, I like that. I think research would bear out a little bit that the microscope beats the telescope. In other words, yeah, I'm thankful for my wife as well. So if we do the telescope, then I don't think it'll have as much stick-to-itiveness. It's when I say, okay, this is exactly what I'm thankful for my wife today, that she made a stop at Sam's Club and loaded up with all this cold meds and chicken soup and stuff like that. So I think that's important. The second observation I make with my students is King David kind of does the exact same thing in Psalm 103. He says, I'm going to consider the benefits of God, and he doesn't consider material benefits. He considers spiritual benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's the forgiveness of his sin, the fact that he's going to be raised from the pit, you know, he'll conquer death, God's loving kindness, his compassion. And so what I think is interesting when I have my students do this list, they very seldom put spiritual benefits. They tend to look at material benefits. And I think that's really limiting for us as Christians, because it's almost like we should have two lists. One, my spiritual gratitude list, which is, man, I'm forgiven regardless of what I've done the previous day. God has still forgiven me and his love has not wavered. So it could be interesting to have two different lists, a spiritual one as well as a material one.
Oh, I love this. That's a really great perspective, Tim. But I wonder, after teaching this, thinking about this, doing this yourself, what is the hoped for end result?
Well, let me tell you how how we're using it at the Winsome Conviction Project is we are going to try to train people to look positively first towards people we disagree with, politically, religiously. Like I'm teaching this to women at abused domestic violence shelters. I'm actually doing it on December 9th, how do you prepare for the holidays, which can be a very difficult time for women in abusive relationships where they get verbal abuse. So I teach them this first. Let's just be thankful and get into the regular rhythm of doing that. Then, once they get that muscle developed, they now need to think about positive things about themselves, which is harder, because when the abuse comes, they need to block that abuse with positives. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about political disagreements, we're really going to try to do this. We're doing it with two mega churches here in Southern California. We're actually going to teach people this positive recall bias, and then we're going to talk about the upcoming election. So when you first talk about President Trump or Nancy Pelosi or Bernie Sanders, you first have to say, to get into the conversation, here's what I appreciate, here's what I recognize about President Trump. Even though I may bitterly disagree with him, here are the things I'm going to start with. And that's what we want to try to change in our discussions about politics, religion, and the things that divide us.
Oh, I see. So you see the silver lining.
Well, yeah. Yes, but you have to train yourself to do it. Mm-hmm. And I would say in today's argument culture, we've actually been trained to do the inverse. We've been trained to see the negative first, not the positive.
Tim, I went back and saw the Mr. Rogers movie, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, a second time.
Oh, yeah.
And while I was seeing the film, I was just realizing how Fred's attitude is one of thankfulness at all times. And this idea of I am humble and I am receiving what I have and I'm noticing it and I'm grateful for it. And it, I have to say, that was a really wonderful addition to this exercise that you had us do.
Coming up,
when God appears to Mary, the future mother of Jesus, he tells her that she's going to bear Jesus and that he's going to save his people Israel.
We'll turn to Christmas when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Oh, come, all ye faithful.
The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. 3969. That's 800-654-3969 or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com.
Born the King of Angels, oh
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Jesus Christ came to earth to die. The second person of the Trinity took on the form of a man to pay the ultimate price for sin, to stand in our place in order to reconcile sinful man to God. In his resurrection and ascension, we have an advocate before the Father, a living testament of victory over death and sin, and an eternal Savior who has called those who believe in him friends. That is the glory of Christmas. And in appreciating that glory, we can sometimes miss the color, the context, and the groundedness of the incarnation in a time and a place in Galilee in the first year of our Lord, A.D. Jerry Bauer, editor of Town Hall Finance, joined John Hall and Kathy Emmons on The Word, 101.5 FM in Pittsburgh.
All right, Jerry, so I never thought of there being an economic message in Luke chapter 1, so tell me about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a couple of things going on in the nativity stories, right? You have the Magnificat by Mary, and then you have the birth in Bethlehem, etc. When God appears, or actually Gabriel, speaking for God, appears to Mary, the future mother of Jesus, he tells her that she's going to bear Jesus and that he's going to save his people Israel. And how does she respond to that? See, this is the really interesting thing. One of the things I like to do when I study the Bible is see how people respond to things, because how they respond to things tells us how they think. And since they're the ones there, how they think is really relevant information to us. So if Jesus comes and says, "Baptize me, John the Baptizer," and John's reaction to that is, "Oh, behold the Lamb of God," and it really gives us an idea of John the Baptist mindset, or baptizer, whatever you want to call him, mindset, in that something about what Jesus said to him implies to John that he's the Lamb of God. And so something about what the angel said to Mary, or Miriam, had a certain implication for her. Whether she's right or wrong isn't the main point, but she is she's a person of that time. So what she thinks it means is gives us a pretty good clue as to what it means then. It's a way to kind of get ourselves into the mindset of the people to whom this is happening. And what she doesn't say, she doesn't do much of a theological treatise. She doesn't say, "Oh, that's really interesting. There's going to be an incarnation, and my child is going to have the essence of God, but he'll have two persons." Now, all of those things are true. I'm an Orthodox Christian. But the fact that her first reaction is, "Oh, you have chosen a woman who's descended from David, who lives in Galilee, and is of the artisan class in order to bear your Messiah," what does that mean for her? Well, it means that, oh, clearly you're going to do mighty deeds. You're keeping your promise. You're going to scatter those who are proud in the thoughts of their hearts. You're going to bring down the rulers from their thrones. You're going to exalt the humble. You're going to fill the hungry with good, and you're going to send away the rich empty-handed. But we have trouble understanding the social dimensions, not because they're not there, but because we don't know enough to know when they are there. Mm-hmm. So if God came to Pittsburgh and started talking about people's lives, and he says, "Well, you need to be strong like steel," we would recognize that that's not an accident, right? We'd recognize that Jesus, you know, here in Pittsburgh, knows the economic basis of the city, or the historic economic basis of the city. So if God went to Wisconsin and he's talking to someone in overalls, or if God goes to Wall Street and he's talking to someone in a $4,000 suit driving a Lamborghini, we would get that. Mm-hmm. We'd know who he's talking to. All that stuff is going on in the Gospels, whether it's fishermen or tax collectors, but we don't get the sort of the economic background, so we don't get that there is an economic dimension to this story. And I've been arguing that there's an economic dimension to this story, but I noticed basically in my devotional reading that that doesn't start with Jesus' stories. That starts with his mother, that his mother interpreted the coming of the Messiah in terms that were both religious, political, psychological, social, mm-hmm. and economic, and that helps us understand why Jesus does the same thing. In fact, later in the Sermon on the Plain, it essentially quotes his mother, "Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall mm-hmm. be satisfied," where his mother said, "He has filled the hungry with good things." Well, both of you who are rich, well-fed now, for you shall be hungry. Well, his mother said that he has brought down the rulers from their thrones and sent away the wealthy empty.
So apparently, Mary had some influence on the thinking of her son because he continues her themes in the beginning of his ministry.
I see.
So the gospel's not changing. The message of Jesus, of course, wasn't changing, but it can be expressed and understood in different ways, as is what different nuances, maybe is the best way to say it. Different nuances of it can be understood in different ways and expressed even depending on who is speaking and the audience.
Yeah, and you'll tend to confront what is the prevailing evil in a particular place. I speak all around the country, and I can tell you that when I speak in Seattle versus when I speak in Washington, D.C., or in New York, there are slight differences. Not because I'm contradicting myself, but because you give the medicine according to the disease. Mm. So what you have in Galilee are different issues. So there are social evils in Galilee. What are the social evils? Well, they're largely, say, bigotry against Gentiles, because up in Galilee, they're bumping up against Gentiles more. It's Galilee of the Gentiles. So Jesus almost gets himself killed in Galilee, not for decrying economic exploitation. He doesn't say a word about economic exploitation in Galilee. Nowhere in the Gospels do you have Jesus in Galilee saying anything negative about wealth. He does say some things about dealing with Gentiles. Like he mentions the Elijah and the Assyrian woman, and he mentions the healing of a leper, you know, from Naaman of Syria. And that's a hot-button issue up there. So he hits their hot-button issue. He doesn't vary so to get himself out of trouble. Frankly, it's the other way around. He varies in a way that confronts. He's more confrontational with the audience that he's with. So he doesn't go down south and decry anti-Gentile bigotry, because there weren't a lot of Gentiles down there, and that wasn't the prevailing issue. The prevailing issue was that the temple elite was essentially ripping everybody else off. So he confronts the evil there. When he goes up north, when he's back home in Galilee, he confronts the evil of anti-Gentile bigotry. Both places, you know, want to kill him, and one place actually does kill him. So he's not varying his message in the sense that he's trying to get favor with men. He's varying his message in the sense that he speaks to the heart issue, including economic, not heart issue as in just your heart, but the central issue in each region. So he's got a different message for Jericho than he does for Bethsaida versus Capernaum versus Bethany. He's always speaking, knows where he is. He's smart. He's not just perfect as the incarnate Son of God. He's also a well-informed man of his time, and he understands current events enough to speak in a way that is specifically tailored to each individual city that he's in.
Coming up?
I can't believe it. That's blowing my mind.
Bethlehem. More with Jerry Bauer when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Pop, pop, that the
Lord pop, will pop, see me through. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water?
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. We are now over 20 centuries removed from the events of that first Christmas. The message from the angel Gabriel, Mary's eloquent response, the Magnificat, her poem hymn of praise, and the unique journey of Mary and Joseph. We would do well to spend a little time seeking to understand something of the social, religious, and economic climate of that day. Let's return for a few more minutes with Jerry Bauer, with John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
What was the industry in Bethlehem? The industry was, you're probably not surprised to hear, that it was shepherding. Mm. But this part you probably haven't heard. It wasn't just shepherding in general. Shepherding was looked down upon by the rabbis because sheep would tend to eat from somebody else's pasture. And so if you were a shepherd, you could not guarantee, according to the rabbis, that your sheep would not steal from somebody else. So the rabbis liked to impose not just rules, but hedges around rules. So they disapproved of the occupation of shepherd, not because it's inherently immoral, but because you can't be sure that your sheep won't graze from somebody else's pasture. So therefore, you shouldn't be a shepherd at all. Well, okay, but there's a problem, which you see right away, which is that you've got a temple system that essentially runs on sheep. You've got lambs that are sacrificed in the temple system. So they had to have a place where you were allowed to have sheep. And so there was a place set up where shepherds could, without disapproval, raise sheep, which could then be exported and sold to Jerusalem as part of the temple system. That place was called Bethlehem. The industry of Bethlehem was to raise sheep that are religiously approved so they could be exported to Jerusalem to be made sacrifices.
That is crazy. That is absolutely crazy.
I never heard that.
Okay, so you see, to me, whenever I speak about this, there's a certain resistance to economics. I don't want to talk about it. That, to me, is like the case that usually gets people to think, oh, maybe the economics really do matter. Maybe there's really something going on here. So Jesus, the Lamb of God, was born in a town whose specialty industry, according to the Mishnah, which is not long after Jesus' time, so it's a recent memory, whose specialty industry was the production of lambs for the temple.
No way.
I
can't believe it. That's blowing my mind.
And the rest of the Gospels are like that, too.
Wow.
The rest of the Gospels all have a dimension. The Bible's like a pop-up book for kids. When you open it up, it opens up through multiple dimensions. And we shouldn't squash it down. We shouldn't say, no, that's money. Or, no, that's science. Or, no, that's politics. I just want to hear about the afterlife and inner tranquility. Because the Gospels are pretty clear that they're certainly about the afterlife. And they're about inner tranquility. But they're pretty clear that they're about other things as well.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. And let me say thanks again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn and Michael Cook, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.